Chapter 3. That evening, as Jim Ferguson walked up the cement steps to the front door of his house, the Venetian shade behind the glass of the door shivered, moved aside. An eye, bright, wary, peeped out, and then the door swung open. There stood his wife, Lydia, chuckling aloud with pleasure, blushing to see him as she always did when he got home. It was her habit, due perhaps to her Greek origins. She ushered him inside into the hall, talking quickly.
"Oh, I'm so happy that you are finally home. What sort of a day did you have this time? Listen, do you know what I've done? In my desire to please, and I know it will please, guess what I put on the stove for you, and it's cooking now."
He sniffed.
Lydia said, "It's chicken. Stewed chicken and spinach."
She laughed as she led the way through the house ahead of him.
"I'm not hungry so much tonight," he said.
Turning, she said,
"I can see you're in a bad mood."
He halted at the closet to hang up his coat. His fingers felt stiff and tired. Lydia watched with an alert, bird-quick expression.
"But now you're home, and so no reason to be in a grumbling mood," Lydia said. "Is that not right? Did something happen today?"
At once her face became anxious.
"Nothing happened, I trust?"
"I know fervently that nothing in the world could happen,"
he said. "I just had a little run-in with Al."
Going past her, he entered the kitchen. "This morning."
"Oh,"
she said, nodding in a somber manner, showing that she understood. Over the years she had learned to catch his moods and to reflect them, to line herself up, at least in appearance, with them, so that a communication could be brought about. His wife was very much for that, for a full discussion of his problems. Sometimes she made out things in his problems that he had missed. Lydia had gone to college. In fact, she still took courses, some by mail. Being able to speak Greek, she could translate philosophers, and she knew Latin, too. Her ability to learn foreign languages impressed him. But on the other hand, she had never been able to learn how to drive, even though she had gone to a driving school. Still, she listened to what he had to say about cars, even though many of the notions made no sense to her. He had never found her unwilling to listen, no matter what the topic. The table in the dinette had been set, and now Lydia moved about the kitchen, getting pans from the stove and transferring them to the table. He seated himself on the built-in bench and began unlacing his shoes.
"Time for me to take a bath," he said. "Before dinner?"
"Naturally,"
Lydia said, at once returning the pans to the stove.
"You would no doubt feel much more at peace with the world if you took a bath."
So he went to the bathroom to take his bath. Hot water roared down on him as he lay soaking. He kept the water going more for the noise than for anything else. Here, with the door shut and the steam rising and the noise, he felt relaxed. He shut his eyes and permitted himself to float a little in the almost totally filled tub. The tiles sparkled with drops of condensation. The walls, the ceiling, became damp, the bathroom fogged over, making the fixtures dim shapes, dripping and tenuous. Like a real steam bath, he thought. A Swedish steam bath with attendants waiting and white robes and towels. He rested his arms on the sides of the tub and with his toes shut the stream of water down to a trickle. He arranged it so that the incoming water was exactly balanced by that drawn off by the spillover drain. Here now, away from the garage, shut in by himself in the warmth and dampness of this familiar bathroom, he had lived in this house for 16 years, he felt no trouble. What a solid old house this was, with its hardwood floors, its glass-doored cupboards. The timbers had become like iron over the years, soaking up the anti-termite compounds that he lavished on them in the early fall. Over the outer boards, coats of paint had become themselves a second house, protecting the first, the inner wooden one. Even this, the enamel house which he had built up layer by layer over the years, would have been enough. After all, wasps made houses out of paper, and no one bothered them. This was no paper house that he lived in. "They can take those pigs," he thought. "Those three. I got them beat all the way around. I could tell them a thing or two, even that last one, the pig that got the credit. Let me ask how long that house of his stood up. This'll be here long after. In those days, in the 30s, they really built. That was pre-war. They didn't use any green lumber." And as he lay in the tub working the controls with his feet, he began to think. He thought, he'd let his thoughts go there, on that old topic. It came to him that there was such a thing as gain. "Yes," he thought, "look what I got. I got $35,000. What a lot of money. And there's nothing I have to do," he thought. "It's already in. It's in writing, a fact. Just lying here in this tub. I'm waiting, and it's getting closer. I can count on it without any work now." So now he did not have to think of work. It had been work that had forced itself into his mind over the years. "They can take their damn cars," he thought, "and stick 'em up their ass. I think I'll never go back there," he decided, "to the garage. I think I'll stay home." "You couldn't get me to go back there," he thought, and he looked with real anger on those who wanted him to get back. He felt real hate. "What'll I do with this money?" he asked himself. "This enormous sum, a sort of fortune. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll leave it to my wife. This big sum paid to me for everything that I've done. I'll be dead, and she'll be spending it, and she doesn't even need it. Has she stood by me?" he asked himself. "Worked at my side? I don't see it if she has. It's the Oakland Public Library that she's supported, not me. It's the University of California and those professors, and especially those students in sweaters. And they dress nice and keep their nails cut. They have plenty of time and training to know to do that." At the door of the bathroom, a faint noise attracted his attention. The knob turned, but the door did not open. It was locked.
"What is it?" he yelled.
"I wanted..."
his wife's voice cut off by the noise of water. He shut off the water.
"It's locked,"
he yelled.
"Do you have a towel?"
"Yes," he said.
After a pause, she said,
"Dinner is ready. I want it to be exactly right for you."
"Okay," he said. "I'll be out."
Later, he sat across from Lydia at the dining table, drinking his soup. As always, she had fixed up the table. She had put on candles, a white tablecloth, and linen napkins. She wore a little jewelry, too, a necklace, and she had on rouge. Her black eyes shone, and she smiled at him, an immediate smile as soon as she saw he was looking at her.
"Why so gloomy?" she said.
"Is it not a lot more happier for yourself and all mankind to adopt a more pleasant exterior?"
When he did not answer, she went on,
"And eventually that affects the inner person. At least according to the magnificent psychology of William James and Lang."
He said, "You got that from your course." Briskly, with no intention of abandoning her mood, she replied,
"Yes, I got that from my course, Mr. Terrible Gloom."
She would fight a good fight for happiness, he saw. Her smile was enriched by determination. It defied him. Under all conditions, behind any reaction, she kept this, the faith. He would get nowhere. "In this house," he thought, "in my house, I can't even be depressed. At least not out loud. It's not permitted. Like dirt. Swept out the door." She moved a little faster. Her hands flew from butter plate to coffee cup to napkin. "Lots of spunk," he thought. "Where does it go when I'm pushing up daisies? I'll push up, not daisies, but skunk cabbage," he decided. "Imagine her at my grave with an armload of flowers from her garden in the back, roses and stuff, and there the skunk cabbage is, growing like hell." He laughed. "Ah, she said in a full-throated voice. It came to his attention, watching her, that she was a lot younger than he. Of course, he knew that, always had the fact available, but he did not usually dwell on it. Her hands, still smooth. Well, she didn't have to scrub them with Dutch cleanser 4 times a day. Who did the floors in the house? She had a colored girl come in 2 times a week. That girl did the heavy work, the dirty stuff. Lydia did only the dusting, the dishes, the shopping, fixing the meals. The rest of the time she was out learning. What did you learn, he said, today?
Are you interested?
She said in a merry voice.
Sure, he said, since I pay for it.
Money, she said, is the arbiter of worth in a society of barbarians who identify themselves by when they see a sacred tablet in the temple made of gold.
Her eyes fixed themselves on him. No timidity there. He said,
you're going to be a pretty big-time barbarian one of these days.
The eyes continued, watching.
35,000,
he said with such fury that she did at last cease smiling.
Why don't you start a fund? The Ferguson Fund for Bums. Pay bums to sleep all day.
His voice rose.
In the parlor, he shouted. On the couch.
His voice squeaky shook.
Here, in my house.
She said nothing. Watched.
Maybe I go see Louis Malzoni, he said. My attorney. Maybe I take the trouble to invest the money in bonds.
But why, he asked himself. Because she got it in the end anyhow, for nothing, for doing nothing. And he, for all he had done, what did he get? But he felt tired. He ate his roll, spread butter, real butter, on it. And all the time she watched.
Describe to me this run-in you had with Al, she said.
He said nothing. He ate.
That is responsible for this overpowering, incorrect view of things as they are, she said.
At that he laughed.
That man, she said, such a deliberate waste of life, as he reveals, and his attitude toward others for what actually lies inside his own inner reality. When he and his wife, the latter whom I care a great deal for, as you know, appeared in this house for dinner on that particular Sunday afternoon, I had an even stronger impression than ever before.
What impression?
Lydia said, are you not acquainted with my impression? Why, that is, I could not say. I know in the past I took pains to discuss it with you. How long is it that he has rented the lot next to you for his cars?
At this point, a number of years.
During that period, I can see in you a change. There is no coincidence. What is it that I remarked when you arrived home tonight? That you were in a bad mood. I am familiar with that mood. Formerly, you did not return home so much in that mood. What is he in your life? He indicates to you the absolute stupidity without hope. Man making himself stupid. But it is you that take onto yourself, for nothing at all, responsibility.
Looking up, he saw that she was pointing her finger at him and frowning.
Because, she said, he has marred his own life with doing nothing. He manages to make you feel that you owe him something. But in fact, you owe him to leave, to have him leave.
Ferguson said, just because he dresses bad.
What, my good dear?
Christ, he said. He tripped over the goddamn ashtray. What about that? All this theory stuff. And you know what it is? It's nothing but he tripped over the ashtray that first time he came here and the way he dresses.
Pardon me, Lydia said, because I know better, my good dear. That man has contempt. Tell me, what is his preference?
He did not understand. His wife had gone into her rapid Greek kind of speech, and when she did so, when she was this way, most of what she said was lost to him. Lydia explained,
what is the church of his faith?
How do I know? He said.
None,
she said.
Maybe so, he said.
Do you know, she said, that what a man believes about God is actually, as Freud showed his attitude toward his father? And a man who has no ability to find in himself any proper reverence in the Heavenly Father, which is a good word, has no father here on earth that he relies on. I want to know what you think about this. What makes the character in this old world of ours? The family. It is in the family that the laughing little baby grows. Who peers down at him over the edge of the blessed cradle?
His mother, Ferguson said.
His mother, Lydia said, is known to him through the tit, the source of eternal plenty.
Okay, but he also sees her, he said.
He experiences her as nectar, Lydia said, as the food of the gods. But the father, he gets nothing from. There is between him and the father a separation, whereas with the mother there is unity. Do you see?
No, he said.
The father, she said, is all society and his relation to it. Once he has that, he never outgrows it. But if he doesn't have it, he can never get it.
Get what? He said.
Lydia said, the trust and hope.
I give up, he said. You better throw in a course in English along with the Plato.
I know, Lydia said, that if you had got a happier man in with you, you would not now look forward so emptily. Another man in your place, retiring with so much accumulated wealth, what would be in his mind? Let me see it and depict it to you, my dear, good dear. Joy!
Joy, he echoed with bitterness and some amusement.
The joy of tomorrow, his wife said.
I'm sick, he said, tired and physically sick. Ask the doctor. Ask Dr. Fratt. Call him up. I mean, ask what the facts are instead of spinning a lot of philosophy at my expense. What am I supposed to do, start taking great book courses along with you? Reading those guys? What do you know? I'd like to see you fix any simple thing there is, like a light cord plug. Fix that and then come to me.
Oh, you're so much like that man, she said.
He grunted and sat rubbing his forehead.
He is that part of you, she said, but you are more. He is nothing but that, nothing but defeat, because he lacks that faith.
At last he resumed eating his dinner, drinking his soup and spooning up the stewed chicken with its cooked, soft, colorless bones. After dinner, Jim Ferguson did something that had become natural to him in the recent years. He turned on the TV set and placed his overstuffed easy chair before it. Not again, his wife would have said, had she still been home, but tonight Lydia had a seminar. She had been picked up by a car. It had honked once, and out she had gone with her books, wearing her coat and low-heeled shoes. And so she was not here to say it. His mind, however, said it for her. On the screen, Groucho Marx insulted some man who had come up grinning, wearing a suit. No matter what Groucho said, the man continued to grin. It was all fun. Watching, Jim Ferguson found himself stirring with restlessness. At last he shut off the set. Is that all they have now? He asked himself. He turned the set on briefly, trying the other channels. Westerns, a panel discussion. He shut it off. Bunch of goofs, he thought. Especially those fairies, those grinning guys who play up to the ladies, give away dishes, kiss old ladies on the cheek, ask moronic questions, a quiz. Good, they got the big crooks, he thought. At least that's gone. Especially that one, that intellectual. What a crook he was. Lydia had liked him so much, that Van Doren. He really took him in, the old man thought, but he never took me in with those manners, that educated crap, that polished front they teach them. Going to the closet, he got his coat. He did something that, although not usual, had come to him now and then in the past. Going downstairs to the street, he locked the front door of the house, too bad if she doesn't have her key, and got into his parked car. A moment later, he was driving along the dark street in the direction of San Pablo Avenue and his garage. That's what college ought to do, he thought as he drove. Give you the knowledge to tell a good man when you meet one. But look at Lydia, taken in by Van Doren. And look at Alger Hiss. Look at how they all fell for him because he had that refined look, that thin face, the dignity and bearing and breeding, even though he was a communist spy. Even Stevenson fell for him. We might have had a president who would deliver the country over to those State Department Harvard queers in their striped pants. The only man who really saw through that was old Joe. And they got him. They ganged up on him because he was too blunt. He called a spade a spade. He thought, Joe McCarthy saw through the lies and fraud that runs this society, and now he's dead because of it. When San Pablo Avenue appeared ahead with its light, Jim Ferguson kept the curb lane. He slowed his car, but not at the garage. Instead, he stopped a block away at a red neon sign, The Ring-a-Ding Club, a bar that he visited when the mood came to him. Quite a few people were in the bar. As he opened the door, noise spilled out over him, pleasing him. And the smells of people, the good, warm smells, companionship, laughter, the racket of life, its characteristic motion and color. At the bar, he found himself a place to stand and ordered a burgie. There were even a few women at the bar, mostly older, however. A glance showed him that they were shrill bags. He turned away. By the entrance, a tall, middle-30s Negro in a topcoat and tan sweater was blowing up a balloon. On the floor beside him, a plump, black-and-white Springer Spaniel panted and lolled its tongue. Everybody seemed to be watching the dog. The Negro blew on the balloon, and it expanded. The people around him shouted different things, suggestions. "What's this?" Ferguson wondered. He turned to watch. The dog, gasping, had risen on his haunches. His eyes were fixed on the balloon, which was now as large as a melon. The balloon was colored red. The man, laughing, lifted it away from his mouth and wiped his lips with the side of his hand. He was laughing too hard to blow. "Here," a companion said, reaching. "Give it to me, man." "No, you let me blow it. He like it better if I blow it." The man blew again. The balloon swelled and the dog watched. Suddenly the man's shoulders heaved and he dropped the balloon. The balloon fizzled away, darting. Hands flapped at it as it bounced to the floor. The dog whined and ran at it, then away again. His round body twitched. Leaning against the wall, the man laughed soundlessly, and his friends groped among the tables and chairs for the empty balloon.
"I got more,"
the man said, reaching into his topcoat pocket. Balloons spilled out like the fingers of gloves.
"Man, I got all the balloons in the world. Let that go. It's dirty."
This time he blew up a yellow balloon. The dog's tongue went in and out, and he swallowed. Strange, Ferguson thought. Why is the dog interested? He thought about his own dog, dead under the wheels of a customer's car. The dog had slept in the garage under cars being worked on. Several years ago now. The yellow balloon had been blown up, and the Negro tied a knot in its neck. The dog on its feet whined avidly and lifted and lowered his head.
"Throw it for him," a woman urged. "Don't make him wait."
"Go on," a man at a table said.
"Yes, go on and let it go."
The Negro, raising the balloon up high, let it fall. The dog caught it on his nose and bunted it. Up went the balloon and drifted across a table. The dog followed, and again he bunted it. The balloon rose and fell, and the dog kept beneath it. People got out of his way. The dog scampered in a circle, his plump body pinwheeling and his mouth open. He saw nothing but the balloon. And when he crashed into a man, the man moved and the dog went on. Ferguson said to the man next to him,
"Hey, they ought to commit that dog."
He began to laugh. He laughed until he felt tears coming out of his eyes. He leaned back against the bar and yelled with laughter. The dog tumbled across chairs and people's feet, lunged at the balloon, knocked it again and again into the air, and then, in his excitement, bit into the balloon and popped it.
Yuff!
The dog wheezed and stopped short. His eyes smeared over, and he sat breathing in huge, rough gulps. He seemed dazed. The fragments of the balloon were picked up by a young colored man in a purple shirt who examined them and then put them in the pocket of his sports coat.
Jesus!
Ferguson said, wiping his eyes. The dog had settled down to rest, and the man was again blowing up a balloon. This one was blue.
There he goes again,
he said to the man next to him, who also watched, grinning.
What does he do? Go on all night? Doesn't he get tired?
That's enough, the Negro said, letting the air out of the balloon.
No, go on,
a woman said.
One more,
a man at the bar said.
He's too tired,
the owner of the dog said, stuffing the balloon back into his pocket.
Later, maybe.
To the man beside him, Ferguson said,
It doesn't make sense. What's the dog get out of it?
The man shook his head, grinning.
It's contrary to nature, Ferguson said. It's perverted. He probably thinks about nothing but balloons all day and night. Nothing but balloons.
Worse than some people,
the man beside him said.
Animals have no sense, Ferguson said. They don't know when to stop. They get an idea, and that's all there is. They never lose it.
Instinct,
the man beside him said. The dog's owner, the tall Negro, moved from table to table with an open cigar box. Bending, he spoke to persons, and some of them dropped coins into the box. He reached the bar.
For the dog, he said. He want to go to school and learn a trade.
Ferguson put a dime in.
What's his name?
He said. But the Negro had gone.
That colored guy,
the man next to Ferguson said, probably trained him for TV. They have those dog acts on all the time.
They used to, Ferguson said. Not so much anymore. Now it's mostly westerns, mostly for kids. I sure can't watch them.
You think if you saw this on TV, this dog chasing a balloon, you'd laugh?
Well, sure I'd laugh, Ferguson said. Didn't you see me just now? I was laughing pretty hard. That's exactly what I want to see on TV. Real entertainment.
I don't think it would be funny on TV,
the man said, on that small screen.
I got a 26-inch screen,
Ferguson said. He decided to ignore the man. Sipping his beer, he gazed off in the other direction. There, in a booth, sat Al Miller. With him was his wife, Julie, and with them was the Negro in the top coat who owned the dog. The Negro was talking to them, and all three seemed to be having a good time and to be absolutely friendly. In fact, from the way Al was gesturing, Jim Ferguson realized suddenly that he was stoned. This was the first time that he had seen Al really drunk. Now and then he had seen him when he had had a few drinks, such as when he had come to dinner. His coordination had been bad, but that was not like this. This was the real thing, and the old man chuckled. He turned so that he could watch. So even gloomy Al, who always went around hunched over, never joking or laughing except maybe in sarcasm, even he let down once in a while. The guy, the old man thought, was actually human after all. He thought, maybe I'll go over and join him. What about that? Watching, he saw that Al was trying to buy the dog from the colored man. He was offering him a check, which he had in front of him and was writing with his fountain pen. Julie was trying to pull the check away from him. She shook her head, no, and scowled and talked to both men. She had one hand on Al's shoulder and the other on the Negro's. To the old man, that seemed funny. So funny that again he began to laugh. Tears again came into his eyes. He set down his drink and got to his feet. Cupping his hands to his mouth, he yelled across the noisy bar,
"Hey, Al, that's just the business for you."
It did not seem as if Al had heard him. The business negotiations continued, both men deeply engrossed. So he yelled again. This time Al glanced up. His glasses were missing, and his hair hung down over his eyes. Without his glasses, his eyes had a weak, unfocused look. He peered about half-blindly, and then returned to the negotiations. He tore up the check with great labored twists of his fingers, scattered the pieces, got out his wallet, and began writing another check in its place. Truckling, the old man swung back to the bar and picked up his beer. What a business for Al Miller, he thought. The perfect business. A dog that bunted colored balloons in bars, and Al could pass the hat for the dog. He thought, so the dog can go to school instead of Al. Hey! He yelled, again turning, but his voice was lost in the noise. It can go to school in your place and get that degree. This time Al did hear him. He saw the old man and waved his hand in greeting. The old man slid from his spot at the bar and made his way carefully through the crowd of people over to the booth. It was really hard to hear. Even when he got over to the booth, he could not make out Al's words. Bending down, he rested his hand against the side of the booth, his head close to Al's.
I couldn't hear you,
Al yelled up.
Send the dog to school,
the old man said, chuckling at what he had said, at what he had thought up.
Instead of you.
He winked at Julie, but she stared past him. Al said,
Hell, I'm buying it to kill it. I hate that goddamn thing. It's an abomination.
Oh, the old man said, still laughing. He hung around for a time, but none of them paid attention to him. They were too involved in their transaction.
This is Tootie Doolittle,
Al said presently, introducing the Negro, who glanced up and nodded formally.
A relative of mine.
The old man murmured something, but did not try to shake hands.
I guess I'll be going, he said.
They had not asked him to sit down. Now his laughter had gone. It did not seem so funny, and he felt tired. I still have to get over to the garage and work, he recalled. I can't stick around here. And what the hell if they don't want me to sit down?
So long,
he said. Al nodded as the old man moved away. I wouldn't have sat down anyhow, he thought as he pushed the door of the bar open and stepped out onto the cold sidewalk. The fresh air blew around him as he walked toward his parked car. He took several deep breaths, which cleared his head at once.
Hell, he thought. When do I sit down with Negroes?
He started up his car and drove the block or so to the garage. Soon he was beneath a Studebaker, alone in the damp, partly lit building, his radio playing from its shelf. As he unfastened the crankcase pan of the car, he thought,
Why am I here doing this, lying on his back beneath the car, alone in the garage with no one even knowing he was there? What was the purpose of it?
But he continued unscrewing the bolts, laboring away.
So the guy can have it back tomorrow? He asked himself. Obligation to my old customers. Maybe it was that. He did not know.
All he knew was that he had no other place to go, no other spot to be. There was really no problem, because he came here without deliberation. He came because he had always come. When there was nothing on TV to watch, or Lydia was out and there was no one to talk to, or things were not too interesting at the Ring-a-Ding Club.
I'll work an hour or so, he decided, and then call home and see if Lydia's back. That won't be so long to work.